the brand new Professor and Barney podcast. It's really popular.
Big response in New Zealand from the first one, I assume?
Huge response. It was actually a record listening... It was a record for listening.
Wow. Each week, a new episode, and every episode, a new topic inspired by a current sporting affair. The latest, cheating, thanks to the Houston Astros.
I guess today's all about cheating.
We're going to look at the best and worst cheaters that have ever sort of graced the sporting landscape.
Great, and we're going the quirky and the weird. So if you've tuned in to hear about Lance Armstrong or Marion Jones, it's not going to happen. We've dug deep. It's going to be some weird shit.
Lawsuits not required.
Yeah. I wanted to talk for a second about the psychology of cheating.
Barney, I think it's important.
Wait, you and I have just been on a two-day trip away together. My missus doesn't need you talking through the psychology of cheating first. Thanks.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Barney, what were you doing when I walked in that room? My God.
This is more of an intervention podcast.
Please search for the Professor and Barney podcast and hit subscribe wherever you do your listening.
Welcome to the follow-on podcast, thanks to Toyota, good for cricket, supporting local grassroots clubs. Brenton Cherry, as always, is with me today, and Jacob Polychronis filling in for Jacob Kurup, both foxsports.com.au cricket journos. How are you both on this fine Tuesday morning? Because we've had a one-day series in India, and there's a bit to dissect.
Yeah, good. It seems a little bit strange to be mid-January and talking about an away ODI series, but that's how the schedule fell. It was an entertaining series, though. Obviously, a bit disappointing the last game. Australia sort of missed the opportunity to claim the series, but yeah, it was a great contest.
Yeah, I think it proved that one-day cricket at its best is still very interesting to watch, and it's engaging, and in conditions where it's batter-friendly, you can get some pretty entertaining stroke play as well. But we'll get into sort of the purpose of the series a little bit later on, but I'd like to start off by asking you first, Jacob, what did you learn about the Australian team from this 2-1 series loss?
I think we learned that maybe there's just been a little bit too much cricket for them. I think the India series came so soon after the 5 tests, and as Chez just brought up, they're not used to touring in January, are they? That throw into the mix the fact that the 3 games were played over only 7 days, it's just a lot of cricket and it's exhausting. There wasn't a lot of rotation, and I think it's just sort of caught up with this side in the end.
And it caught up with them in the last game really as well, didn't it? Two hard fought opening games. But I mean, I guess they were all pretty close. But Brenton, what did you learn about the Australians?
Probably a couple of things. I think that Marnus belongs at the international level for ODI cricket. Obviously, we've seen what he's done at the test level in the last sort of year. But I think he showed enough in that series with 2 innings that he has the game to be an excellent white ball cricketer. I think he got a 50 and a 46 and, played the spin well, was able to rotate the strike. Didn't kick on, but, we're talking about his first 3 games. He didn't bat in the first. So I think that the takeaway from that was that he's a great option in the middle order for us. I'd also probably say any fears around Steve Smith and ODI cricket are gone with it, 2 brilliant innings, and that was fantastic to see. And you could, I think it was 3 years since his last ODI century. So
yes, is that top four? Is that a top four that can win a World Cup in 3 years' time? I understand there's a little water to go under the bridge until then, but Labuschagne at 4 or Smith at 4, either way around, probably Smith at 3. And then Warner and Finch at the top, they'll both be, 36, 37 by then. Is that a realistic goal for the Australian team to have that lineup?
Definitely. I think it is. I think it is a top four that can win the comp, provided you get the next few batting spots right. And we're going to go into some depth with that. Yeah. But I think they got it wrong. And as a result, there was too much pressure on the top four. And I think you could see it in the way Smith and Marnus batted in that last innings. That last ODI, that they knew there wasn't a lot to come. And I think it inhibited the way they batted through those middle orders. They weren't able to be as aggressive as they would have liked if they had other players, i.e. Maxwell, ready to kind of explode later. But I think that's a top four that a lot of sides would be worried about facing.
Did we get sucked in by Ashton Turner's 84 or 40 balls last year against India? It was an unbelievable knock, and it was one of the great one-day knocks of the last few years for Australia, really, if you're going to put it into context. But, I mean, this middle order, to me, just wasn't a powerful enough middle order to make big scores. Yes, they can get to 280, maybe 300 if one of the top three or four bat through. But as soon as Steve Smith got out in that third one day, he just knew we weren't going to be able to kick on, Polly, and it showed. And with Mitch Marsh sitting at home, who can hit Yorkers for six, with Glenn Maxwell sitting at home, surely the selectors would privately admit that they got this wrong and they erred in the team selection.
Yeah, I think so. I think you hit the nail on the head when you asked, did we get sucked in by that 84 or whatever it was? And yeah, I think the answer is absolutely. That was a very special innings, and it came in India against India. So
it came a while ago, though. There's been a lot of cricket between now and then, hasn't there?
Yeah.
It was a very good point. Yeah. It was a very long time ago. And as I mentioned before, Jacob Currie actually rightly brought up the fact that Ashton Turner during the IPL last season was out for three consecutive ducks, and he kind of hasn't really been the same player since. So I think you look at that special innings back in March last year, the IPL failure comes after that. So that probably should have been given some better consideration. And it's just been a long time since Turner's really made some runs. So yeah, I think absolutely got that wrong. And as you said, Tom, there's probably one person in particular who really should have got that, but it's Maxwell is such a no-brainer, I think.
Polly, yeah. You mentioned he hasn't got runs for a while. Looking at his List A record, I'd suggest he hasn't really scored big runs ever. Like, I mean, he's right. Probably got some odds. 1,000 runs at 32. I mean, this is a guy we're hoping is going to drive our middle order. This is in List A cricket. I'm just not sure they're the sort of stats we should be looking at.
He's kind of one of those, like, Justin Langer pets, isn't he?
He is. Has to be. And I think Ashton Agar's in the same category.
Yeah.
I think, Tom, you mentioned that did they not have the power? Ashton Turner actually is a very powerful player, can clear pickets. I just don't think he's got the craft in his game that if he is required to come in sort of the 30th over, he can build an innings as well as someone, say, a Maxwell can do. I think Maxwell's frustrating. He's that sort of enigmatic talent where he shows us what he can do and then Australians kind of hope to see it on a more regular basis and it doesn't seem to eventuate. But Coley summed it up when he was speaking to Aaron Finch about the Australian squad and asked where Maxwell was and was stunned that he wasn't in there. And that says everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does. I mean, it's like any sport. I could speak about AFL, but I'll use the global game, football or soccer. You could have 7 gun strikers in your squad, but you can't play them all in the one team because they don't fit. So while Ashton Turner might be in Australia's, and he might not be, but if he is in Australia's 5 or 6 best white ball batsman, he doesn't suit that 5 or 6 position in exactly the same way as Marcus Stoinis didn't suit the 5 or 6 position in the World Cup. It's such a specialist role that in a previous generation, Michael Bevan played so well. Michael Hussey was one day player of the year a while ago playing that middle order role. And now we need to find the next generation of middle order players, and they probably need to be more attacking than what they were 5, 10, 15 years ago because teams are scoring bigger. So then you've got to ask yourself, well, if Turner has replaced Maxwell in this team from a one-day World Cup, what has Turner done to usurp him? Now, since the World Cup, Maxwell has made a 65 off 28 balls or whatever it was in a T20 at home. He's then had time away from the game, and then he's come back. He's made himself available for this tour, and he hasn't been selected. Ashton Turner captained WA to a Marsh one-day cup series win and did very well as skipper. But I remember before that game, there was discussion whether he should actually be in that team. And now that he's in the Australian team, he needs width. And I was speaking to someone yesterday about Ashton Turner. They reckon he's a very talented player, and I agree he's a talented player. But you just can't compare Maxwell. In fact, you can't compare Maxwell with anyone, can you, really? Mm. Maxwell can do what Steve Smith can't do. He's such a unique player. Maxwell absolutely cost us.
Maxwell can do what very few people in the world can do. And we've made this point on this podcast a lot. It comes down to sometimes what would oppositions least like to come up against. And I guarantee you, Maxwell versus Ashton Turner, they'd be queuing up to face Turner. And now I'm not trying to be too hard on him. He's got some absolute talent. And it's not his, he's getting picked. It's not his fault. But Glenn Maxwell coming in behind the top four we've just mentioned, you know, with someone like a Carey at 5, gives us a lot more options than Ashton Turner does. And I think the other name that I'd probably bring up is Ashton Agar coming in at 7. That just makes me quite nervous. I mean, he's obviously picked...
It's one spot too high,
you reckon? It is. It's one spot. If you can accommodate him in an order and get him in at 8, I personally don't think his record means he should be there, but that's a bit better. But 7, especially with, you know, we're going to go into the Australian lower order woes soon, but especially with that him coming in at seven just makes that batting order a bit too thin.
Yeah. Do you think, Polly, they use this series as a bit of an experimental series as well? On one hand, they actually picked a really strong squad with all the gun senior players to win it. But do you think sort of positions 5 to 8, that they're still trying to work out exactly what they're trying to do?
Well, if Mitchell Starc coming in at number 5 is something that they actually think is a legitimate way going forward, then I'd be really worried. But yeah, I think that selection in itself, it was probably a bit spare at the moment, and I believe Kuldeep Yadav was bowling at the time, and they probably thought that Starc could take him to task. But yeah, that smacks of a bit of an experiment to me, and also just to tie back into the middle order woes, which we were discussing just before, I think it speaks in volumes about that if we need to try and trust Mitchell Starc to come and tick things along. So there was a bit of an experiment about this, but on the whole, not really. I mean, you look at the top of that order, that's what you want it to be for a long time going forward. We took the best of the bunch in terms of our bowlers. So again, really, it's just like those one or two spots which aren't really nailed down. So there wasn't a great deal of experimentation, but yeah, there was a bit there, I think. I'm not too sure what you thought about I mean, Chez has spoken a bit about Agar and where he actually fits in with this. Is Agar an experiment in itself? Is why didn't Nathan Lyon go?
I think there was a view in the Australian camp after the, did we play 6 T20s, 3 against Pakistan, 3 against Sri Lanka, that Ashton Agar, aside from David Warner, was actually Australia's best performed player across those 6 T20s, and they wanted to reward that. So I understand that, but
I don't think that should be criteria for selection in ODI side. They're just so different. They're so far apart now with the skill set you required. I mean, Agar's, I'll read out Agar's stats. From 12 ODIs, he's taken 10 wickets of 57. He scored 180 runs at 22. That's not with the bat, that's actually okay for someone who comes in down the order. But you'd have to suggest he's in there primarily as a bowler. Now, that's not great. And at a list A level, at first class, he scored 700 runs at 24 and 63 wickets at 36. So it's not...
It just screams a bit of bits and pieces, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is unfortunate at the moment.
It is. Mm. It's just not... And against a team like India, they're not going to be worried by those sort of numbers, and you know, they play spin as well as anyone. I don't think a sort of, I know they wanted another spin option, but I think the attacking option is to go Lyon in that instance. Obviously we've talked about the batting order being a bit thin from sort of 8 down, but if you get the middle order right and get the right players in there, then I think you can afford to play Lyon, and that is an attacking option. Playing Agar for me is a defensive option.
Right.
And
I just get worried that Australian teams look for all-rounders. It's been almost an epidemic for about 20 years. But I don't think you should be selecting all-rounders unless they are justifiably good enough with one of their skills to be in the team.
Spot on.
So Shane Watson was an all-rounder, but he was clearly good enough for a period of time to be a batsman in that team. The bowling was a bonus. On the other side of the coin, you could argue that someone like James Pattinson or Pat Cummins, when they're batting well or when they were batting well, could bat at 7 or 8 in the right conditions because their bowling would get them into the team and the batting would be good enough as well. But trying to select someone that's sort of equally good at both but not good enough at either is just a recipe for disaster.
And it's not typically how we've played our cricket, is it? Either, is it?
It's not.
And I think you're spot on. You've got to be able to hold your spot in the side. And all the great all-rounders have been that. Your Jacques Callis, you know, Freddie Flintoff, obviously, you know, with his bowling. Yeah. Those guys were world-class in one discipline, and it was almost a bonus that they did something else. There aren't too many cricketers around, especially at an ODI, that we'd say are really effective and dominant sort of bits and pieces cricketers. I mean, and Ian Harvey sort of comes to mind as someone who wasn't necessarily dominant with either skill, but was quite useful. But
he also had dominant players around him that were generational. So he probably didn't need to be. You could probably afford to carry him as sort of a role player. One of the arguments I heard last night actually for not selecting Maxwell was that he's got such a clear weakness against the short ball in international cricket that that would have been exploited, then he needed to fix that. Do you buy into that at all or not, especially in Indian conditions?
Not in Indian conditions, I don't. Yes, Bumrah's, you know, they've got some sharp bowlers, but not in those conditions. That some of those pitches were, you know, I think the second one was a bit quicker, but they were a bit slow, as they typically are. I think, though, we've seen in the ODI, in the Big Bash, he's adopted a new technique with a view to dealing with that. Now, it remains to be seen how that would have gone in the longer form, being, you know, 50 overs, but sort of opened himself up to access the ball off those shorter ones. But, I don't really buy into that as a legitimate threat.
Polly, I'm intrigued by Aaron Finch's role in this entire thing, because I think we underestimate how much of an influence Finch has in selecting the team and the squad he wants. And surely, having played so much cricket with Maxwell and seen him at his best, he would want Glenn Maxwell there in the side with him. He makes them a stronger team. I just wonder whether they wanted to make Maxwell appreciate the opportunity, knowing that he's going to come back in down the track. It might have been a bit of a sort of a longer-term tactic for Glenn Maxwell.
But are you suggesting, Tom, that this was like they were trying to give him a bit of a wake up call?
I think so. I was going to add to this. Well, obviously, you know, you talk about, did he need a wake up call or to sort of, you know, appreciate the position? Well, Langer was quite strong in the lead up to this series about the reasons why Stoinis and Maxwell weren't picked, and part of what he said was that, you know, they had a pretty ordinary World Cup. So I think there's I wouldn't say it's a punishment, but there needs to be, you know, there's definitely an acknowledgement from Langer's end that this is, you know, a product of poor performance, and that's definitely come into it. Now, I would argue that if there were guys coming through that had really good stats and performances on the board, that's fine. But if they're still the best available, you pick them. Maybe that's a bit too black and white, but I guess that's where I stand.
Well, one other thing I'd just say about Maxwell is that sometimes I think we as the public are quite quick to forget the past. And I think one thing with Maxwell is that in the past we have jumped on him very quickly when he hasn't done well, just because he's a little bit different, he's a bit unorthodox, and there's a certain way sometimes we expect our cricketers to play, and he doesn't always fit that mold. So the one thing I would say is that it probably should go both ways. We probably shouldn't immediately think that he's the answer to all our problems just because we haven't got a win in the past couple when he hasn't been there. He's just one of those characters, isn't he? It's a bit of a hot topic.
Yeah, people love talking about him. It's amazing how interested people are in the Maxwell show. I certainly hope he gets back in the team soon. One player I do want to talk about on a positive note is Adam Zampa. I think his cricket's improved unbelievably over the past 2 or 3 years, especially. I actually think one-day cricket's his best format. Brenton, I'm not sure what you think. He's actually better in the one-day format than T20 cricket. And the fact that he managed to dismiss Virat Kohli in the first game, you could argue that actually won Australia the match because of the importance of Kohli. He's a fulcrum in that order. What else can you say about the way Adam Zampa's career has transitioned, and does he need another spinner alongside him?
It's an interesting point. I would have, like I said before, I would like to have seen Lyon picked alongside him. I think it's a...
But how do you fit him? How do you fit Lyon and Zampa in the tail? Do you have two pacemen and then Mitch Marsh, for example?
Yeah, that's probably the way to go. I think it would be, the other option, I think that's the right way. I think you've seen with Mitch Marsh's form, test, this is aside from tests, where he's a very hot topic around selection, but in ODI cricket, his bowling's useful and he has that power ability. If he's coming in at seven with the right guys like Carey and Maxwell, whatnot, I think that balances the side well. In terms of Zampa, I think he's just knows his game so well at the moment. Clearly he's not a massive turner of the ball, but he sticks to very precise plans, and he's become extremely accurate. He's always, he's never a sort of a overly expensive bowler, but he bowls a sort of trajectory that a lot of cricketers find hard to get at. And you wonder with Kohli whether or not, you wonder whether Kohli just doesn't rate him and he's sort of going after him, and that's really just falling into Zampa's trap a little bit.
I think there was definitely a bit of that early on, and Mark Waugh was one who was pretty quick to point out that maybe Kohli were showing a bit of lack of respect. But I would also say that I don't think by any means had Zampa really got the better of Kohli across his career. I mean, Kohli is still taking him for, I think, more than 30 runs a wicket. And scoring more than a run of ball. And I think we should be careful if we're going to suggest he's in bunny territory or anything.
I definitely don't think that, but you also can't ignore how many times he's got them. I don't think it's necessarily all because Zampa's got the wood on him. Some of it would obviously be coincidental, but there's definitely a way he's bowling at him that just seems to be unsettling Kohli to a degree.
He bowls very straight.
And you can tell he wants to get after him and assert the dominance over the main Australian spinner, which is, leading from the front. And Kohli knows that if he puts Zampa under immense pressure early, that sort of throws the plans out of whack. And it's just backfired a few times. And that's a credit to Zampa that he's been able to hold his nerve whilst Kohli's going at him and dismiss him. That's incredible.
He's been ballsy, I think, the way that he continues to flight the ball and sort of resist that urge to just dig it in a little bit quicker. And that's just how I saw his performance. I think he just showed a lot of courage to keep flighting it up there, Tom.
Yeah, and I think Nathan Lyon would be a great foil for him as well. I agree, if you can fit them both in the same team, I reckon that's a pretty nicely balanced bowling lineup, especially in subcontinental conditions, which we know the next World Cup's at. We also need to thank our major sponsor, Toyota. Thank you for their work they're doing for the Good for Cricket initiative, having raised over $3 million for grassroots cricket clubs over the years and continue to support the growth of cricket. And we've been digging into some of our cricket superstar players from past and present eras. And the Adam Zampa story, we've just touched on it just then, is rather intriguing. A Shell Harbour product on New South Wales' south coast as a junior, Zampa bowled medium pace, but Cricket Australia had placed restrictions on how many pace bowlers were allowed to bowl in under 14 matches. So he decided to change his bowling style to leg spin, inspired by, Fox Sports and Australian Test cricketer Shane Warne. Zampa made his way into the Oz Under-19 team in the 2009 and earned a rookie contract with the Blues in 2010. After playing a role representing Australia in the 2010 Under-19 Cricket World Cup campaign, which they won. He's 27 now and playing an important role in Australia's shorter formats. Once again, a big thank you to Toyota for their commitment to the health of cricket at a grassroots level, doing a fantastic job as always, Toyota, and thanks for their support on the Follow On podcast. Pat Cummins, this is a topic that I didn't think we'd be talking about at all this summer, but it's his failures, and it's not his failures with the ball. He's the ICC Test Bowler of the Year. It's his failures with the bat. So across the last 12 months, Aussie batsmen 8, 9, 10, 11, there's a table, and we're going to do an article on this for the Fox Sports website. And in that table, it makes it very clear that Pat Cummins has had a terrible 12 months with the bat. He's had 31 innings. This is across all international formats. His highest score is 26 not out, and he's averaging 8. To put it into context, Mitchell Starc's averaging 22, James Pattinson 21, even Nathan Lyon's averaging 15. The other thing that I find alarming here is that across this period, Pat Cummins has made 8 ducks. No one else, no other bowler, 8 to 11, has made more than 1 duck. What do we make of this rapid dissension into a proper tail ender, which no one expected?
It's a bit concerning because I think we spoke last year during the India series that Pat Cummins was starting to move into all-rounder territory.
I think that's what did it.
Which is looking a little bit of a stupid take at the moment. I don't know. You wonder how much circumstance comes into it in terms of when he's coming in, but that's a pretty substantial drop because, that India series, and I think also during the Ashes he played some useful innings as well. He was, digging his head out of serious trouble at times and technically look the goods. We talk about the middle order issues, but if you're number 8 he's getting knocked over for bugger all constantly, that's really exposing your lower order even more. So that's a problem, and that's whilst you might think, oh, that's number 8, how much of an impact can that have? I think it can throw the team's sort of structures out of whack quite a bit.
No, in all seriousness, I think that it is a mental thing. So, Chaz, you mentioned that we were speaking about him in sort of all-rounder territory, and I don't suggest that was the talk around the team either, but I think with runs comes a bit of expectation, comes a little bit of hype, and that if Pat Cummins was starting to feel that he could and was perhaps somewhat expected to contribute a decent amount of runs for the team, then I think that plays into his nerves. He's very nervy, and That's what, eight, was it eight ducks, Tom? I think that's what that shows.
Eight ducks and 31 innings.
If you can't get away, that's just nerves. It's not so much a technical thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I think expectations is exactly what you've just said. He sort of, and people knew he could bat, but he in the like, prior to this.
When did he move to number eight? Did he move? He went 9-8 in the Indian summer, did he?
Yeah, I think so. And he played some.
Him and Stark swapped.
Yeah, which was at the time quite interesting because Stark's record's pretty good in white ball cricket as well. You know, he's got a test 99. So that was a little bit of a surprise. But then he came along with, you know, against that red hot Indian bowling lineup, was playing some substantial innings. Obviously, it's probably a bit of a stretch to suggest all-rounder territory. But, you know, what we were talking about was the fact that Australia had a healthy-looking, you know, tail at that point with him coming in at eight, Stark at nine. Now, all of a sudden, he scores runs, and the expectation is he's going to do that more often than not. Clearly, that's had some sort of impact on him. Technically, I haven't probably analyze it closely enough to see if there's, you know, any obvious ones, but the stats are there and they're kind of hard to ignore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a worry. I agree with you there. It's just something to watch out for, I reckon. You know, we think he's a gun bowler. We know that he's such an important player to the team, but the Aussies can't afford to have a number eight test batsman making a duck almost every three times he walks to the wicket.
Those are the stats of a number 11. Now, I definitely don't think he's a number 11. He's, you know, maybe it's a case of he drops down a spot, but you're definitely right. I mean, you look at some, England are a team that really, you know, traditionally in the last sort of half a dozen years or more have had a really effective number eight. Australia talks about playing, you know, specialists. They do sometimes look for these bits and pieces, cricketers, but what the byproduct of that is that they've had guys like Chris Wokes. Now, I wouldn't actually suggest Chris Wokes as a bits and pieces cricketer, but someone like Chris Wokes coming out to bat at number eight, or a Moeen Ali when he dropped down the order, compared to what are we getting at the moment, eight runs? Yeah, that's an area that needs to be addressed.
Well, where do we go from there? Is just dropping him down the order the solution, or is that going to affect his confidence more, Tom?
No, you just drop him down and you say, that's okay. Like, we've got Mitchell Stark who can bat there, or James Pattinson in test cricket, and go and be a bowler and relax a bit. I mean, I think it does it. I mean, Adam Gilchrist often spoke about the fact that he didn't enjoy batting at seven because it gave him more rest. He enjoyed it because there was less pressure on him. And when he went up to even five or six, he felt like he had to bat more like a batsman. And Ian Healy often spoke, I think he's told Tim Payne to bat like a keeper. There is something to be said that if you walk out at number eight, you're sort of expected to do something. At number nine or 10, anything's a bonus. I think that plays a big part. Yeah. We're going to talk just for a second about England-South Africa, not as much about the series. It is shaping up to be a pretty exciting finish, 2-1 to England. They had a pretty convincing win at Port Elizabeth. But the news of this series has revolved around Kagiso Rabada. So a little bit of background if you're unaware of it. He breached Article 2.5 of the ICC's Code of Conduct for using actions, gestures, language, which disparage or which could provoke an aggressive reaction from an opposition batter. That batter was Joe Root, the England captain, who he bowled on day one in Port Elizabeth. He was fined 15% of his match fee, but an accumulation of offences, this was his fourth, meant he misses the next test. The first offence was Shikhar Dhawan, which was a send-off and a one-dayer, and the other two offences were against Australia in that famous Sandpaper Gate series of February 2018. Do we like what the ICC has done here or not?
No. Stop sanitising it. it's a joke. You're robbing the spectators and the fans of the best bowler of either side for the deciding test. It's a disgrace. I mean, look, yes, he probably went a little bit. He screamed close to Joe Root, but there's a motion. It was a big wicket. He's the gun batsman in the side. You know, he didn't get right up in his face. Yeah, he got it probably a little bit too close. But, gee, that's enough to make you miss the game. Now, I know it's accumulation of he's been a bit of a naughty boy at times. And if he gets in his face and swears at him, I've got no issue. But Joe Root, you know, he talks about eliciting an aggressive response. Joe Root's not going to, you know, turn and front on Kagiso Rabada, is he?
Do you think, Polly, that that Kagiso Rabada, when he performed this action or this celebration or, you know, release of emotion, would have thought he would have breached an ICC code of conduct or not?
Of course not. No. It's a spare of the moment thing. You want your players to be all in. You want them to be all in at all times, and everyone loves seeing a bit of emotion on the field. No, we don't pay tickets and we don't pay for subscriptions to watch robots. So
Test cricket needs characters. Yeah, it does. It's a game that's struggling. And Kagiso Rabada, on one level, he's one of the most talented bowlers in the world, but he's also, you know, quite a fiery character.
Yeah.
And we love that. I mean, Merv Hughes used to get in batsmen's faces, and we love him for it, don't we? And look, anything physical obviously is complete no-no, and you can't get in the batsman's face. He got close, but
swear, but
I think we all know when it goes too far. That for me definitely didn't.
But it's one of those ones where it's probably the right call for the wrong reason. So I think in the wording, I mean, there's probably no way he can get away with it, because in that wording which you just read out before, Tom, I think he's guilty, and cricket, rightly or wrongly, still wants to hold on to this gentlemanly image now. But I think we're well past that. It's 2020 now, and I just think it's need to change the interpretations of it. But
clearly he's been done, because it could provoke an aggressive reaction from a batter. But I guess anything could provoke an aggressive reaction from a batter at any time.
But there's lots of, like, you know, there's lots of comments from the huddle that get fired at batsmen when they leave that, you know, probably are more likely to elicit an aggressive response. But yeah, I think it's just a bit over the top.
And are we going to turn a blind eye to the countless sort of send-offs that, like you said, just happen in these huddles, whereas Rabada's just screaming, is he not?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I think he's just screaming at the floor, which I actually quite enjoyed. And there's a great photo of him screaming on a length while Joe Root's off stump has been ripped out of the ground. Just one thing on this. I've been really interested to listen to what the greats of the game have said about this incident. And Michael Vaughan was very strong and agreeing with what both of you have said. Michael Atherton was a little bit more measured. Michael Holding, to me, has been the most interesting person about how he has evaluated this situation. Because remember, he famously kicked over the stumps, I think, when he didn't get a decision that went his way. Now, that was aggressive towards an umpire, and that's clearly wrong. But he said it's like breaking the speed limit in a 30 zone. You know you're doing the wrong thing, and if you get caught, you shouldn't complain. I don't agree with him, but I know where he's coming from, if you know where I'm coming from.
Look, it's hard when the rules are set to sort of argue that he should a certain way. The rules are there, they're pretty clearly defined. But we need to think about Test cricket as a product, and some common sense needs to come into it, doesn't it? You know, you've got a great series here that's being robbed, again, like I said, of one of the most exciting talents. And he didn't threaten anyone. Mm-hmm. He didn't get in the face. He went a little bit over the top with his celebration.
Just on that, Chez, is that we are also, I think, excusing Rabada himself a bit here. So Kevin Peterson came out during commentary and made a good point that Rabada has, considering his record and the fact that he's done it before, he's left his team in a hole by doing this. Now, like we said, it's probably not on his mind at the time, but he also does have a role to play in this, and he might have just stitched his own team.
Well, you're probably right, Paul. Like, I mean, I can obviously argue the merits of whether or not he should have been banned, but he has to know he's close or walking the line in the sense that he's been banned before and he keeps getting cited. Mm-hmm. Now, I would argue that that's wrong in terms of the decision-making around his suspensions. But, yeah, it's not very smart, is it, when you know what the rules are and you know you've got priors? I think you're spot on there, Paul.
When you've got three priors, you don't even get close to that imaginary line we always speak about, do you? You completely steer clear of it just to make sure. Mm. And he's only 1 month away from getting a clean slate, because it's a 24-month sort of cycle. So he's only 1 month away and he's completely stuffed it and he'll miss the next test.
It's clearly an off-the-cuff emotional reaction. I mean, surely he's not dumb enough to think he's, you know, to plan that out.
No.
So it's a little bit hard to, you know, I can feel for him in that sense, but yeah, you've just got to try and control yourself, I guess.
Quick BBL preview, because we're going to look ahead to what I think is the most star-studded Big Bash game of all time. The Heat versus the Sixers on Thursday night. For the Sixers, you've got Lyon, Smith, Hazelwood, Henriques, many others. The Heat, Lynn, AB de Villiers, Marnus Labuschagne is back. Joe Burns is opening the batting in Test cricket, and he'll play, we expect, and James Pattinson as well, and others. Just a quick one on the Heat. These collapses have been an epidemic over the past sort of 2 years, but it's become even worse over the past month. Who's to blame, and what do the Heat do about it? Because it's actually really impacting their entire brand as a club, not to mention the fact they're losing games consistently.
Well, I wonder whether or not it's a bit of a recruitment issue in the sense that they've gone for these big name, big hitting stars over the years. But you wonder, like, is there too much investment at the top end and then it falls away too much if those guys fail? If sort of Baz McCullum, when he was playing, Chris Lynn, go off, it all looks great. But if they fail to fire, the guys coming in, because you've spent all your money up the top, the same sort of thing happened to the Thunder when they paid Warner and Chris Gayle all that money. Mm-hmm. You know, the talent depth isn't there and in the salary cap to, you know, hold the team for the whole season. So I wonder if that's where it is. They've sort of just invested their money a bit too heavily in a couple of big hitters. And as we know, they can sort of be rocks or diamonds at times. Although you'd argue that AB de Villiers should be good enough to do that job, but he just hasn't in this instance.
Yeah, it's been really disappointing to watch. Losing 10 for 36 was
ugly.
Debacle. I mean, probably even the worst stat than that was 7 for 7 in 16 balls. I mean, it just losing a wicket almost every second ball. Darren Lehman's got some soul searching to do along with Chris Lynn. Chris Lynn's been reasonable in fairness,
but
they need
fun.
To change something. Yeah.
But what do you think about, I mean, Chris Lynn was pretty strong in that. I know he put up some runs and then caused it a piss poor performance towards the back end. I mean, he's absolutely correct, and piss poor is probably putting it lightly, to be fair. But
yeah.
But also, is it a leadership thing? I mean, normally when you see big collapses like this, it doesn't even have to be a collapse. It could be throwing away a lead in another sport or something like that. That tends to be a leadership failure. It's a lack of someone being able to go out there, calm the troops down, and just get the job back on task. So,
yeah,
I know it's harsh to say that, you know, Chris Lynn's not a bad. We don't know what he's like as a leader, but I think maybe
but it's been happening so much that you start looking in for areas where it might be. Yeah.
I mean, when Chris Lynn got out, the score was an 84 after six overs. I mean, he would have thought, I've actually done my job here. Like, I've set us up. We only need, what do they need, a run a ball or just over a run a ball after that? It was, it's a whole club issue. It has to be a whole club issue. And I've been intrigued listening to what Brendan McCullum has to say, given that he was there last year when they had some terrible collapses. The first game of last season, they lost 8 for 23. Don't forget that. So he was very much a part of that. But this is going to be a ripper game. Nathan Lyon, Steve Smith, Josh Hazlewood, Sixers versus the Heat. I can't remember a game that is more star-studded in Big Bash history. Can you?
No, that's world class. You know that. Yeah. If you want to go watch one BBL game this year, that'd be the one to go to.
And you can watch it on Fox Cricket, of course. Quick one from you both. Give us an early tip for who's going to win this summer's Big Bash. Who do you think is going to come on Trump's?
Can't go past the Stars for me. They just got too much depth. You know, and they've got their big players are in form as well. Mm-hmm. You know.
What do you think, Polly?
I'd like to say the Stars as well, but I'm going to go a little bit offbeat and go the Strikers, not because I am a proud Adelaide boy, but I think they're building momentum, let's say. They're building momentum, yes. and they kind of have these old school weapons like Peter Siddle's Yorker. He's been fantastic at the death. Obviously, got Rashid Khan, who continues to be outstanding. I think Travis Head, now that he's getting a couple games under the belt, is looking strong. So I think they're and Carey's coming back into the fold now. So I think they're trending in the right direction. And
I've been really liking Harry Nielsen's keeping as well.
Yes.
When I think he's a very underrated Australian keeper. I think he's probably in the top 3 or 4 Australian keepers. It's a shame that he's sort of sitting behind Alex Carey. And the other underrated player they have in terms of one skill is Wes Agar. I think he's one of the best Yorker bowlers in the country. His wide Yorker rarely misses the mark.
Mm. Well, there you go, Chez. Is that one Agar you like?
Yeah, well, he's sort of, to be fair to Wes, Wes is really, he's had a big year. You know, he's turned himself into a very useful and important member of the sort of South Australian setup. Mm. Whereas he was sort of on the fringes for a while. But I think he might have gained a yard of pace, and he's a big guy. He's
still quite young as well.
He is,
22,
yep.
I believe. So.
And Ashton might be a little bit upset because he seems to have kept most of his hair. So that's a bit, he's got that going for him. But no, he's done, he's sort of come from nowhere a little bit, and he's definitely a threat.
Yeah. Who have you got, Tom, by the way, in terms of BBL? Sorry, mate.
No, I think the Sixers are going to win. I think the Sixers have the best lineup full strength when they get Smith back. They'll get Sean Abbott back soon. Steve O'Keefe is back from injury. Plus Hazlewood, plus line. I mean, I think it's a pretty ridiculous team that Greg Shippard has assembled. And Josh Phillippe at the top of the order, I think he's a star young batsman as well. I really rate what the Sixers are doing. And as long as they can finish in the top two and get that easy pathway to the grand final, I think they'll be favourites. I worry about the Stars, aside from Maxwell and Stoinis. I worry about what else they've got. And that sort of got proved at the SCG the other night. I know they didn't play a full-strength team, but I'm not sure the rest of their batting is necessarily that strong. They'll get Peter Hanscom back, which helps, but they're relying heavily on those two guns, it must be said. They're two very good players. Fellas, we've got to wrap up. It's gone for a bit too long, but I've enjoyed talking cricket with both of you. We'll see your work both soon on foxsports.com.au. And this has been the Follow On Podcast, brought to you by Toyota. Good for cricket.